All right, let's go to the phone line. This one with the mic that works, and we'll get the level up just a little bit. There we go. Great. Go to the phone line. We've got Mr. William Prentice on the line with us, the CEO, the founder of ESG in Energy. That's a title I just impromptu did, and I kind of like it. He's with Meridian Energy Group. He's building refineries across the United States that are progressive on a micro level that actually are the next step of innovation, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And we reached out to him because I, you know, my notes are a little bit scrambled, and I don't know if it was Exxon or Chevron, but it was some of the one of the big oil CEOs that came out and said there won't be another refinery built in the United States. And I thought, well, I've been interviewing a CEO for a guy out of a company for 7-8 years now, and they're building them, and they got a couple of them lined up. So Mr. William Prentice, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you, Jason.
Hey, what's going on with this CEO talking about, you know, there's going to be no more refineries being built in the United States? Because I thought, you know, you and I have 7-8 years worth of interviews that kind of document the fact you are building one.
Yeah, and that was the Chevron CEO that said that. And I tend to agree that there probably will never be a large refinery again built in the United States. There are a lot of large refineries shutting down over the past couple of years. I don't agree that there will be no new refineries in the U.S. because Meridian's going to build a bunch of them. You know, the fact is that it's really difficult to get a large refinery done through the federal permit process. But we have designed and are going to build small, clean, and very profitable refineries that are permitted under state jurisdiction, and we'll just seek out states that want a refinery to serve their local and regional consumers, and that's where we'll build them.
What type of relationship, what type of response are you getting from the states? Because the first thing that I think of is the direction we're going with our food. Every day we're going more and more towards the micro farmers gardens, farmers markets, all the way to your backyard. So these micro refineries, that is the next step in energy, because refineries, they need to be around for a while at least, and they need to become cleaner and more efficient and et cetera. So is there a response, like a correlation of that, you know, how we're moving ag from, you know, the big corporate ag down to more of the farmer's market type thing?
Well, I think there's probably a pretty deep relationship there. I mean, when you're getting into an era where there's an extraordinary level of, let's just call it interference, to be blunt about it, on the part of government into business, government naturally targets the larger enterprises. That's why there's such a intense give and take right now between the Biden administration and so-called big oil, you know, Exxon, Chevron, Marathon, et cetera. But that creates huge diseconomies of scale. Now, we're not talking about a micro refinery. I mean, for the Davis refinery in North Dakota, it's 50,000 barrels per day, and it's going to cost us $1 billion as we build it. And that's, you know, it's not exactly a mom and pop kind of a thing, but it certainly is a lot smaller than what you see Exxon or Chevron talking about when they envision expansion into any of these areas. But I think the trend is going to be in the smaller types of processing, both in ag and in refining. We are right now witnessing within our industry, because of the prevalence of biodiesel and ethanol and other bio-derived hydrocarbon fuels, it's been integrated into our design. You know, we're going to be using 2,000 barrels per day of vegetable oil at Davis, which provides further in-state markets for and processing of ag products, as well as for Bakken crude oil. And it's because of the size of our facility we can do that.
Let's take a second and just let the audience know which refineries we're talking about here with the names. So when we're talking about the Davis refinery, which one is that?
Okay, the Davis refinery is the one we've been working on for 8 years, actually. It's located west of Belfield and just east of the Freiburg crude by rail terminal, just right south of the interstate. That is a 50,000 barrel per day refinery, actually 49,500 barrels per day. And it's going to produce gasoline and diesel fuel and some butane and propane and so forth. The project's, it's, you know, as I mentioned, been going since 2014. We began permitting in 2015. Got our permits as of June 2018 with the air quality permit from DEQ. We promptly got sued and spent several years in litigation on various permits. All of that was finished late 2020, just in time for COVID. And during the process, we've continued to work on it. And under a contract executed almost exactly a year ago, we began the detailed design and procurement and the construction of the Davis refinery. There's going to be some site work going on this summer. We've got to dewater the site now. And then next year, next May, we'll start working on the rail facilities and doing foundation. So, you know, again, it's a new refinery permitted under state jurisdiction and law. And it's the basis of our other planned refineries in Texas and Oklahoma.
Have you been, has the state been giving you any economic money or anything like that? I saw that that refinery in Dickinson that's changed hands a couple times, and I still remember that red carpet, literal red carpet ceremony where they did actually bring out the red carpet, but I had never seen so many dignitaries and everything for this refinery outside of Dickinson. And then I saw just last week they got another $340 million. So the state really seems to be invested in that refinery outside of Dickinson. Have you been given any support from the state that would even be 10%, 20%, 100%, 200%? Do you understand my question by that?
Yeah, and I appreciate the question. I apologize to you know, the state of North Dakota and my shareholders that I do not know how to do that. I do not know how to seek government aid to build a pure free market facility for a development stage company that wants to be an agent of change in this business. I think the market should be the basis for what we're trying to do. And it's not our policy to ask for anything from the government. For instance, you know, we've not requested any tax relief or anything. We're going to pay our taxes. You know, Davis is going to triple the budget for Billings County and add about 1,200 to 1,400 jobs in the area. That's what business is supposed to do. I apologize to everybody. I don't really know how to go about getting $300 million from somebody in the state or the federal government.
It's interesting you say that because I was just having this conversation this morning about the industrial forest because I feel like a failure because I put together a plan where we had the city of Bismarck on board and we had a sustainable solution and we had a track record and everything else, and we lost out to the same old nonprofits that ended up killing the trees anyways. And so we were just talking about how it is. It seems like there has become a very government-controlled marketplace when it comes to dollars and cents. And when I was growing up, people in the government were there because they couldn't hack it out in the professional private sector. And now since the government has really gotten into business for a lot of different ways, when they fail, they get bigger. And this is a very difficult, interesting time we're at. And that's a whole different, I don't need to get into that too much because I've been going on that, and I don't want to get you involved in that political stuff because this is supposed to be a non-political platform and program. However, what I'm going to cite next is another example of what I'm talking about, which is Senator Cramer has been going on all these talk shows, Ludlow, Kudrow, I think you name it. I mean, anything on a 24-hour news network, he's been on. And he's supposed to represent the state and the businesses of the state. And I've never heard him talk about your refinery one time. Has he ever talked about it? I've heard him talk about they're shutting the refineries down, agreeing with the Chevron guy. So, sorry to put you in the crossfires with Senator Cramer, but he's been kind of making me perk up a little bit over the past year with some of the things he's been saying and doing. So would you care to comment on that?
Well, I don't want to say anything that would upset Senator Cramer or people on his staff, but, we are, in fact, doing a lot of good for the state of North Dakota. And when somebody's out there talking about the refinery industry, I think it was an opportunity to maybe give us at least a honorable mention that would have assisted in our public profile. But then again, I can't say that would have been nice when I also say that we steadily ignore government, try to do things on our own with our head down and not depend on government for anything except for them to do their job as far as evaluating and awarding permits is concerned. We did, because of the fact that Senator Cramer and, others from the North Dakota political landscape have not been very vocal in their support, a number of our shareholders, and I think about a third of our shareholders actually from North Dakota, got very upset with me for not saying something. So I did, send Senator Cramer a letter just updating him on our process and where we are in the project. And just as a reminder, because, in the past we've met with Senator Cramer and Senator Hoeven and, Mr. Armstrong, and just to keep them up to date. And, not that we've ever asked for anything, but it's polite to let them know what we're doing. But again, I'm not in the business of asking government for anything, but it would be nice to be remembered when, at a time of such dire urgency in the industry, here we are with a shovel-ready project that we're actually in construction on, and it'd be nice to be noticed and given some credit for being there with a solution.
Well, let's talk about the solution, because that's really what we try to do at The Crude Life, first of all, is find experts that are solving problems out in the marketplace. And you've been doing it. I've talked to your engineers, Zia Engineering and Dan Hedrington out at the project manager. I've talked to the people out in Bellfield. I've talked to the local county commissioners. You name it. I mean, it's like I said, it's been well documented. So let's educate these people about the Davis model and what's enabled Meridian to really do what you're doing and say that, hey, the impossible word is not something that we should be saying in today's economic and political and environmental climate. Let's educate them a little bit.
Well, yeah, thank you. And I do love to brag about what we've done, so I do appreciate that opening. When we started this project, we're not a big oil company. We started from scratch, which in the energy industry means we were able to cheat, because we could start with a blank sheet of paper and do things the way we considered right. And so at that time, we're also looking forward to a election in 2016 that had the possibility of giving rise to an administration that was not very friendly to two crude oil, based businesses. Little did we know what we'd end up with later. But as a result of that, we decided to focus on a refinery that incorporated everything that was now available as far as technology is concerned, and incorporated into a smaller refinery that, although it meets all the federal requirements for emissions, is actually permitted under state jurisdiction, giving us the ability to go to other states, as I mentioned before. As you also know from our past discussions, of course, the perfect location for the Davis refinery happened to be too close to, for comfort for many people, to the TR National Park. So it put even more pressure on us to make sure that we were very clean as far as air emissions are concerned, for instance. But that turned out to be a good thing, because the project that we've designed for Davis has 1/8 of the industry average, the U.S. refining industry average for total emissions. And for greenhouse gas, it's less than 40% of U.S. average. If we got credit for that, the carbon credits just on that reduction from other refineries' carbon emissions would be enormously valuable. There's just no way to monetize those in the U.S. today. But it did give us a way to build a cookie cutter, and we are going to be able to put this in other locations, and every time we do that, we're going to be the cost leader in those areas. So we'll force essentially other refineries, either foreign or domestic, to back off, and it'll be cleaner, it'll reduce emissions in the United States, and it'll also create more competition for the consumer at the pump. And competition, as we've seen, is a way to control pricing. I should say a word on behalf of big oil. I'm often openly critical of the big guys that are out there in our business. But, they've had a horrible job trying to figure out what to do. First of all, over the last 40 years, in terms of meeting demand and trying to cope with environmental concerns at a scale that makes sense to them to make the investment. But most recently, can you imagine being Chevron or Exxon right now and having the administration beating on you like a drum to expand capacity when you're already operating like 94%, 96%, which is not good for the industry. There's going to be safety and maintenance concerns emerging if we keep that up. And it would take 10 years, even if Exxon or Chevron could build a brand new big refinery in the U.S., because that's what it would take to get it through the federal permit process. I feel really bad for those guys. But my job is to continue on the road that we've charted out and build these smaller plants and do what we can over the next 10 years to build, five or six of these refineries out there and help take up the slack on industry demand.
Yeah, I tell you, when I'm looking at what's happening right now, is I kind of saw this happen in the newspaper industry when they wouldn't let go of the printer, the printing press. The printing press controlled their industry for 20 years too long, and it bankrupted a lot of newspapers because they wouldn't adapt and they wouldn't get rid of the old ways. And that's what I think the sunk cost in the industry is right now, is that there's some, whether it's cronyism or nepotism or good old boy network or whatever you want to call it, I think that's the biggest sunk cost right now, because they won't change. They don't want to change. They don't see what's happening on the outside world. And it's creating a world to where politicians and lawyers are changing science. And that's a dangerous world when politicians and attorneys can change science. But That's deemed too political, and I think that's more fact than political. But anyway, so I don't know if you want to comment on that, Hot Potato.
That's too hot for me.
Okay, good deal. Okay, so let's. I do want to ask you though about the actual science behind your facility. You said you learned some things, the short and long term advantages. What are they then? I mean, because that's science. What are the short term impacts that are positive, negative, and the long term ones?
Well, I mean, just if you talk to any one of the people that are running a major domestic refinery, you know, it's when I look back at what I know about the way things are done and in the industry that goes back 100 years and the differences that we've incorporated into our design, it seems like a nightmare to me. You know, you're sitting on the coast, you're trying to figure out how to maximize your production, you're trying to figure out how to minimize your cost of crude. So you're making deals, you know, month in, month out, with various parties for the crude oil that comes in. You have a plant that's very complex, and different parts of it are operated at different levels depending on how you put that crude together. There are constant system upsets. It's very hard to control. You know, one of the things that's most notable about a traditional refinery is the flare stack. And you can sort of tell how they're doing on any given day by how big that flame is. And, you know, when you're cycling between different blends of crude oil and different product mixes, for instance, in California, depending upon the location and the time of year, there are over 50 different categories of gasoline and blends that you must come up with to serve those markets. It's a nightmare. So I feel bad for those guys. And, you know, when I compare it to our job, again, we cheated, started with a blank sheet of paper, started with Bakken oil, which, except for maybe Saudi Light, is probably the easiest oil to refine in the industry. And you build a nice, tight, compact, efficient design that is only going to use that crude oil. And, you know, none of this mixing and matching or anything like that. And the ability to put together something that's very clean and efficient and has a low operating cost because of that efficiency is just so refreshing to me as an engineer that I honestly get very excited about being able to get Davis started up and showing how this should be done. And, you know, we're going to take that same approach, as I mentioned before, to the other shale basins in the United States. And help those areas have a competitive source of refined products as well.
So when you go to these other shale basins, I know that the Winkler, Walton, Kermit, I think Kermit's the city. Walton is the name of the refinery, and Winkler is the name of the county?
Yeah, you got that right.
Okay.
When
you go there, and then I heard you talk about Oklahoma in a previous interview too, so I'll let you talk about those in a second. When you go in and talk to the officials or whoever you need to talk to, obviously the Davis refinery comes up as your proof of concept. Now, the fact that you got permitted, because you are permitted, and you are next to that Theodore Roosevelt National Park, is that does that help or hurt, or do you bring that up, or, you know, talk to me a little bit how you navigate through that, because what you've done is absolutely amazing, but somebody just might not agree with it because all of a sudden, you know, they're greenwashed or climate changed, whatever the case is. So I imagine you even got to be a little bit, you know, tiptoey about certain things till you kind of read the room a little bit. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and I think that particularly in Texas, West Texas, there's a growing awareness that there has to be some further in-state processing of crude. I mean, you know, the site you mentioned, we had to put that off because we weren't certain that the family that was going to be hosting that facility was 100% behind it. So we're actually looking at a different site right now. But you know, there are probably five locations in West Texas that we are looking at right now. One of them will be our next refinery site, but the others will eventually host a facility like Davis. And the fact that we have permitted this facility in North Dakota, the fact that the EPA, for instance, was consulted by the state authorities and I believe also the county in North Dakota before permits were awarded, means that we've really gone through the gauntlet already. You know, we also, in order to access institutional funding for our projects, we had to go through a very rigorous ESG review with our investment bankers and pass that with flying colors too. So we have a lot going for us when it comes to introducing this concept into a new area. And yeah, it's been extremely helpful. And quite frankly, looking back, I'm grateful for the intensity of the permitting effort that the state and the county put us through, because the body of knowledge that we have now and the intellectual property we developed to be able to cope with that is extremely valuable, and it does make a big difference when we move into a new area.
Are you getting into the ESG business now, since you're one? I mean, you got to be one of the experts. I mean, you've done a couple ESG reports, and where are you at with the ESG world? I mean, like I said, in my opinion, you're one of the experts. So,
well, you know, it's kind of funny, Jason, because when I first heard that acronym ESG, I wondered what the hell is this now, and I realized, you know, that was baked into Davis from day one. The company was founded by some North Dakota expatriates that they couldn't find jobs when they got out of high school or college, so they went all, you know, to Portland and California and so forth. They wanted to create jobs so that there would be that many fewer of those conversations around the breakfast table when a kid couldn't find a place to work. So that's what they wanted to do. The social part of it, the S and the ESG, was a foundation principle of the company. You know, we have made that part of our corporate strategy from day one, even before ESG was kind of a known terminology out there. So, you know, I mean, obviously we were going to be able to score very highly on that, especially on the E. You know, if you look at it incrementally, every barrel of oil that we process into refined products, we get rid of 7/8 of the emission that would have otherwise gone into the air in the United States. It's even greater than that if we're offsetting refined products that are imported from some other country. So, you know, it's doing a lot for the nation. And, you know, the country has done a lot as far as decarbonizing over the last 30 years. So we agree with that as a need in our marketplace, whether it's being driven by government, you know, actions or not. The market wants to see U.S. industry utilize less carbon. So that's what's been happening for a long time. And we're glad to be a part of that. But yeah, ESG is in our blood now.
Energy Secretary Graham, she's Granholm. Granholm is how you phonetically say her name. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Granholm, I think it is.
That's what I thought. Yeah, I was thinking Graham and Granholm. I get it kind of confused. So in my head, my phonetics radio news, I just say Granholm. That's why I always say Josh Duhamel. He gets so mad when I call him that. it's how it goes some days. She's meeting with these refinery executives this week, next week, something like that. Any thoughts on something like that?
You know, I mean, that's a that's a media event. It has nothing to do with us. The government likes the fact that there are some big refineries out there, big refiners out there that they can deal with, you know, in a small conference room, so to speak. You know, Biden's letter went out to 7 CEOs, and that's fine. That's big oil. Government feels comfortable dealing with the major firms in these industries. I don't expect any solutions. After that meeting, the Biden administration will be able to point to those refiners and say they wouldn't help, and oil is bad. And big oil will leave that meeting and be able to posture themselves, position themselves properly as far as defensive lobbying is concerned for the next couple of years. And their objective is to utilize the refinery emergency as a way to loosen regulatory controls that might allow them to, let's say, expand existing refineries a little bit quicker. So, you know, that's what's going to happen. It has nothing to do with us.
It what you were just talking about reminded me of what soured me on the process when I tried to get involved in my 20s. Into either not even politics, just the process was. It was very apparent what a dog and pony show was. I always heard that term, but when I saw it before my own eyes, what a dog and pony show was, oh boy! And is that what you think's happening? Where they're just gonna both, you know, the Biden administration is just kind of fait accompli. They've already decided what they're going to do. They're having this meeting. No matter what happens, they're still going to move ahead no matter what?
Well, I mean, yeah, their position is unchanged. It's a very unfortunate set of circumstances for both parties. You know,
it is.
Big oil has been expecting to be cracked down on, and they have industrial policy in the U.S. Create incentives to move away from fossil fuels into other areas, and they've been, you know, making steps in that direction without really knowing, you know, where it's going to lead over the next 10 to 20 years. There's a lot of uncertainty because, you know, they just don't know yet whether their responses to these industry pressures are going to be productive and leave them still in a position of market prominence. And government, you know, they Biden administration came in thinking, okay, it's now time to try to push people out of, you know, fossil fuel-derived transport fuels and into electric vehicles and other more benign, environmentally benign modes of transport. But, you know, partially as a result of COVID and the resulting monetary and fiscal policy that you know, the federal government felt compelled to put into place, we have inflation and price increases that happen way too fast for any of the gradualism that was thought would take, you know, take the stage here for the energy transition. Instead, it all happened too quickly. So it turns out that, yes, the fact that we've lost 1 million barrels per day of refining capacity in the United States hurts. The fact that we have inflation hurts, and it's amplified in the energy sector. So what do we do about that? Well, in a complete free market society, when these forces began to appear, you would have seen a little bit more energetic investment into the refining sector. But, you know, the administration can't yell at Exxon to tell them to increase capacity when they're already operating at almost 98%. To do that, to respond, build more capacity, would require certainty of the recovery of your investment. And the next day, you'll hear the Biden administration talking about how we're going to get rid of the oil industry. I think, you know, the recent episode, somebody sent me a YouTube clip of where the Fox correspondent asked our current press secretary, whether or not the oil industry was going to be allowed to have some certainty under which it could make the investments to correct this refined product shortage. And she essentially ended up her answer by saying, well, we're not going to need any of that stuff in 4 to 5 years, so maybe not. You know, when you have that kind of statement combined with Biden's letter to the oil industry executives, in any other nation, that would have been considered kind of a run-up to a nationalization-type battle. You know, those are the kinds of communications from government that preceded, for instance, the takeover of the energy assets of various firms down in Venezuela. Energy executives don't ignore those things. Energy investors are concerned when they hear those things. So it's very counterproductive if they really want a response in the industry to these shortages. But, yeah, I mean, the fact that energy is so expensive, and you hear certain Democratic politicians bragging about having acquired electric vehicles, and they don't care about gas prices now. It's just... it's an irresponsible approach to the energy transition.
Coming out, I'm in Gillette right now, Wyoming, and as I was driving into town, first time I've been coming out here for 5 years, and the first time I saw this was rail cars filled with coal as far as the eye can see. I mean, it was like a stockyard of cattle except for cars of coal. And I thought, wow, this is a – I got to get a picture of this when I leave town because – I'd never seen anything like that. And I thought, well, I guess that's our energy reserve for the summer for air conditioning. I've seen what they're doing with coal, and the difference between like coal and fossil fuels is quite considerable. You know, the Davis refinery, aren't you guys doing jet fuel and stuff?
No, we're putting all of that part of our crude cut into diesel fuel.
Oh, okay, diesel. Okay, so diesel. I was going to go diesel next, but I thought jet fuel is part of it, so I apologize. But the diesel part, for farmers, that's huge in North Dakota. Just the fact of saving the transportation of getting the diesel to, that's the part I don't get, is that there's no way we can go off of a fossil fuel society within the next 30 to 50 years. It's just not even feasible. And to have any leadership even try to talk themselves out of it is very irresponsible. It is. Anyway, so I just am.
No, you're right. I mean, we'll be doing jet fuel out of our Texas and Oklahoma project.
Ah.
There's more of a demand that's unmet right now in the region around North Dakota for diesel, including Arctic diesel. So we're going to focus on that, and it will change the dynamics of the fuel markets in those areas. You know, we're also going to be producing butane and propane in the area. In the past has seen shortages of those products as well, so we're going to provide an in-state processing capability for all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the fact that you're seeing coal trains again is interesting. There's been a lot that's happened in the area of coal processing that can make that a much more benign, cleaner energy resource as well. But it's got a bad rap, so you know, it's people are not very welcoming of coal.
I've very rarely have I seen leaders throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, I get that sometimes you got to reset. Even, you know, God in the Old Testament did the flood. That was the throw the baby out with the bathwater. And they just seem to do it every couple of years. Every couple of years, it's like, nope, we're going to polarize this way and we're going to polarize this way. And people are craving purple. They don't want this extreme blue or this extreme red anymore. They just want something purple. And it's they'll take the Vikings might be the most popular football team this year. Might be. Anywho, what kind of summary wrap up should we do here? What should you people walk away from this interview knowing, or what do you want people to know walking away from this?
Well, I don't know. There's been a lot in the news about refining. It's very political now. You mentioned the meeting in Washington. I don't think much is going to happen as a result of that that would impact everybody's daily life. You know, for the last 8 years, we've had our head down doing our job, and we're going to build Davis. It's in construction now. You know, it's a heavily modularized project, so you're not going to see a lot of dirt flying in the air till next year, but it's still being done. You know, we just kind of look at this, all this activity and publicity surrounding the industry and shrug our shoulders. We're going to keep doing our job and go forth and build refineries. That's what we're here for.